Hello, I'm Dave Daigle from CDC Media Relations, and first our apologies for starting a little bit late and our thanks for hanging around with us. Today we have Dr. Ann Schuchat, who's going to update us on the ACIP meeting. Dr. Schuchat is our director of the National Center for Immunization and Respiratory Diseases. Dr. Schuchat?
Good afternoon. Today, the CDC's Advisory Committee for Immunization Practices convened in an urgent meeting that was scheduled outside of our usual three times a year meeting schedule. The committee was asked to deliberate about the H1N1 vaccine, and they were asked to look at two particular questions. Target populations that ought to be the focus of immunization activities, and the second question was about prioritization and who ought to get vaccine first in the circumstances where there may not be enough. The ACIP is a committee that includes 15 members. They are doctors and scientists, vaccine experts, those with expert in public health or clinical care, and there's a public representative as well. This is one important step in a longer-term process to plan for prevention and preparedness around the 2009 H1N1 influenza challenge. And so this is one part of a broader vaccine development, production, and planning effort. The committee healthy discussion, reviewed the epidemiology and the science, and really made two critical recommendations that CDC will take under advisement. They recommended five target groups for the initial focus for immunization. These are groups that had higher risk of disease or who had greater burden of complications, and they're five groups that will be very helpful for our planning purposes going forward. They include pregnant women, household contacts of children who are under 6 months of age, healthcare workers and emergency medical services personnel, children and young people between the ages of 6 months through 24 years of age, and non-elderly adults with underlying risk conditions or medical conditions that increase their risk of complications from influenza. These are generally populations that were defined by the epidemiology of this 2009 H1N1 virus outbreak. And these are the recommendations that will really help our state and local authorities go forward with their planning efforts. Second key question that they were asked to deliberate about was prioritization. If the populations for whom vaccine is recommended are larger than the amount of vaccine that we will have, ought we to prioritize or not? And they really discussed this in two ways. First, they said that in general, under most circumstances, we really ought to promote vaccine in all of these five focus groups, and that picking among them or prioritizing some before others would not benefit the public. We've learned from shortage situations in the past that when we really focus very intensively on prioritization, sometimes we have vaccine left at the end of the season. So their default really was that prioritization probably doesn't make sense in this circumstance. We should really go out full force to identify opportunities to vaccinate these five target groups. But they also did consider a just-in-case scenario, a prioritization scenario that might be necessary if the initial supplies are very limited or if in local communities there's just not quite enough, the demand and supply aren't matching. And so they did come up with a prioritization or a who's first in line kind of scheme. And again, there were five groups in that prioritization, but it's a much smaller total population. That prioritized small group, which really won't be used under most circumstances, but we'll have in our pocket in case we need it, includes, again, pregnant women, household contacts of children under 6 months, a subset of the healthcare workers and emergency services personnel who have that direct patient contact or direct contact with infectious substances, children between the ages of 6 months and through 4 years of age, and children 5 to 18 years of age who have underlying risk factors that put them at greater risk of complications of flu. So that's a much smaller subset than the first one, but our real operating assumption is the states will go forward with the broader group. As I mentioned, this is just one part of a broader plan around vaccination planning and really around preparing for the H1N1 virus and other influenza viruses that will be coming soon to a place near you. It's very important that we remember seasonal influenza vaccine is recommended for a lot of people. The committee emphasized how important seasonal influenza vaccine is and that recommendations for that vaccine really need to go forward, and we should be offering vaccine as soon as it's available. There are other steps involved with the vaccine decision-making. As you know, there are other advisory committees. There will be a public engagement effort over the next month, which is going to seek some public input into this vaccination effort and really understand values in the communities around the country about this. And there'll be clinical trials that are being launched very soon here in the U.S., some that have started in other parts of the world, that will help us understand more about the H1N1 vaccines that are being developed. I know everyone wants to know, when will we have vaccine and how much will we have? And as we've been telling you, influenza vaccines, whether they're seasonal or this new H1N1 vaccine, production can be unpredictable. Right now, we are on track expecting vaccine doses in the fall. Exactly how many, exactly when will be tough to pinpoint, but we have a lot of planning assumptions that we're working around, and those are part of the broader story. So I think the key message today is that a very important step occurred in our planning for vaccination for the fall, that an evidence-based process led to recommendations for people who are at higher risk of disease or complications to be a focus of our immunization efforts, and that as a public health community, a medical community, and a public sector, we really want to work together going forward to protect ourselves and our communities from this new influenza. So I think right now we should move to questions, and I apologize again for keeping you here late today.
Do we have a question in the room? Betsy.
Thanks, Dr. Shuka. Betsy McKay from the Wall Street Journal. Excuse me. I wanted to ask right off the bat about prioritization, because this broader group includes roughly 160 million people, maybe smaller, and we also learned today that the number of doses expected to be available in October is probably between 120 million and 160 million. So assuming that you need two doses, that's not going to be enough to cover that group. So how do you see this playing out right off the bat?
Right. You know, that's a great question. We think it's really important to differentiate the size of the target populations from the number of doses that we have and the number of doses that we need. We know that with seasonal influenza, we actually recommend the seasonal influenza vaccine for 83% of the country, a huge number of people, but we actually only reach less than 40% of the people, so that we know that we have 120 million doses the past couple years, and really there's, I think, about 280 million people that are recommended to receive the vaccine. Pretty clearly, if we use seasonal influenza demand and uptake as our sort of expectation, we may have plenty of vaccine right away. On the other hand, there's a lot of uncertainty with this particular virus. We don't know exactly what supply or demand will be at any one time in any one community. And so the committee took that under advice and really tried to come up with scenarios to plan for. And that was why they did come up with that just-in-case prioritization group, which is actually only about 41 million people. As you mentioned, the two-dose idea, we do think it's likely most people will need two doses of this vaccine, and that's the way we're planning. We'll learn more, and as we go, we'll share whether that turns out to be the case.
Thank you, Betsy. Can we take one from the lines, operator?
If you do have a question, please press star 1. Our first question comes from David Brown from the Washington Post. Your line is open.
Yeah, thank you very much. Dr. Shuka, can you talk a little bit about the over 25, you know, the 25 to 64 and then 65 and over? It got a little complicated towards the end of the meeting.
Yes.
And also an unrelated question, since thimerosal, you know, is the issue that never goes away. Is there going to be enough thimerosal vaccine available for everyone under, let's say, age 5, you know, who wants the vaccine?
Thanks for those questions. The 25 to 64-year-old population includes people who have underlying risk factors that put them at greater risk for complications of influenza, and that group is one of the target populations that we really hope will be the focus of immunization efforts initially. The committee also deliberated about others in the 25 to 64-year-old group who were healthy without those underlying conditions and presumably who didn't already have another a condition like being a healthcare worker or being pregnant or being a household contact of a person under 6 months. And for that healthy, really unaffected 25 to 64-year-old group, the committee recommended that after the initial focus, that that group ought to be offered vaccine, that it was important to address demand in the first five target groups initially and make sure we really reached them, but that healthy adults would also be offered the vaccine. They next deliberated about people 65 and over, and that's a very important group to discuss. People 65 and over are very high risk for influenza complications from seasonal influenza, and it's very important that people in that age group get their seasonal flu shots, and they're actually pretty good at getting seasonal flu shots, and we really want to encourage them to do so. The H1N1 outbreak so far has, to a large extent, spared that population, and so that group was voted on last, and really the idea was after these other younger age groups have been addressed, if supply is adequate, if global circumstances and the epidemiologic data permit, vaccine could be offered at that time. But it was really a sequential group, the five target groups first, that healthy adult group next, and the 65 and over later. And I think we really want people 65 and over to know how important seasonal influenza vaccine is, and as soon as it's available, it's a good thing to get. So far, the H1N1 virus has been spearing those people to a great extent. The second question was about thimerosal-free. The government has procured doses of thimerosal-free vaccine, two forms. There's needles and syringes that are being prepared thimerosal-free, and there is the nasal spray, which is, does not have thimerosal in it. That's licensed for children 2 years and above, all the way for adults up through age 49. So we do think that there will be thimerosal-free formulations available for those people who are interested in that sort of preparation. In general, of course, the ACIP and the CDC does not express a preference for thimerosal-free based on the science about that component. Another question from the
sure.
room?
Mike.
Okay.
Thanks. Mike Stobe from the AP. Doctor, one question just to clarify. When we talk about how many doses will be available this fall, there's a little discussion about how many micrograms of antigen will be in each one. How many micrograms per dose are we talking about when we talk about those number of doses, and could that change depending on additional information that comes in?
The planning assumptions for discussion today were that the vaccine would contain 15 micrograms of antigen for the inactivated form, and essentially that we would use the amount of antigen that the seasonal flu virus vaccines contain for this H1N1. So it's 15 micrograms, and it's equivalent for the LAIV in terms of potency units. The planning assumptions are reasonable. The FDA is considering this right now. They're deliberating, but they're likely to consider this a strain change, just substituting one seasonal flu virus strain for this H1N1 virus strain in terms of formulations. And so that's where the 15 micrograms comes from. There will be trials that will look at dosing, look at a lower dose and a higher dose, and trials that will also look at the 15 micrograms with adjuvants to see whether we get a whole lot more bang for the buck. But I think most of the experts right now think that the 15 micrograms dosage is very likely to be the right one. Okay, phone next.
Our next question comes from Emma Hitt with Medscape. Your line is open.
Yes, thanks for taking my question. How do you expect the H1N1 vaccine to be delivered alongside the seasonal influenza vaccine? Can they both be received at the same time or delivered simultaneously?
Thank you. Some of the studies that are being carried out will look at simultaneous administration versus sequential administration of the seasonal vaccine and the H1N1 vaccine. Now, of course, for planning purposes, we're assuming that the seasonal vaccine is going to be available first, and we really want to encourage people to offer that if they're a provider or a program, and to receive it if you're one of the people recommended to get it. But there's likely to be overlap this season between seasonal flu vaccine being offered and the H1N1 vaccine being offered. Our assumption is that it's very likely they can be given together. There'll be more data coming out about that, but for the time being, we're expecting it's likely they can be given at the same visit. there'll be more information about that. It was very clear from the committee's recommendations today how important they view the seasonal influenza vaccine as, and that that's really the base from which we expand in terms of thinking about this H1N1 vaccination effort.
Thank you.
Back to Dan DeNoon.
Thank you. Dr. Chuckett, the committee took adjuvanted vaccine off the table today, and so all their recommendations apply only to the licensed formulation. Can you explain a scenario going forward how we might consider adjuvant and how the committee's decision might affect the use of adjuvant should we decide that we need to use that?
Adjuvants are components of vaccines that are often included to increase the immune response to the vaccine. And there has been discussion that sometimes adjuvants could be dose-sparing, and sometimes they might broaden the immune response and perhaps be helpful in expanding the immune response if there's a strain, if the strain changes a bit. So the way that we're thinking right now is that our base case is unadjuvanted vaccine, which we believe could be used as a licensed product and available probably a little bit quicker than the adjuvanted form could be. With adjuvanted vaccines, you have trade-offs of how much benefit would you get in terms of a better or different immune response, and will there be dose sparing, but also what are the safety constraints. Here in the U.S., none of the adjuvants that are being considered are licensed right now, so if we went for an adjuvanted vaccine, it would be used under what we call an emergency use authorization, really special circumstances. And so we are evaluating the need for adjuvants, but our working plans right now are that we're expecting not to need them. This is something that the inputs will be changes in the virus, you know, major antigenic changes in the virus that make the immune response with a non-adjuvanted vaccine unacceptable, and a challenge with the dose, really not having an immune response from this particular one where we really, you know, would need such a large amount of antigen that adjuvants are needed. Neither of these two circumstances are considered by the experts very likely, but we're going through the steps to make sure we have adjuvant available and to study it because it's very possible we would need it.
Let's take another one from the phone.
Okay.
Another one from the phone, please, operator.
Yeah, from the phone? Okay, there we go. Okay, next question.
Our next question comes from John Cohen.
Hi.
With the Science Magazine. Your line's open.
Thanks for taking my call. Just a point of clarification, I don't believe FDA does license adjuvants. They license products. But I could be wrong, but I'm fairly certain that's accurate. I had two quick questions. One is about the process of recommendation. What does CDC do at this point, and what's the timeline for adopting the recommendations or rejecting them? And what's the timing of clinical trial data and availability of product and making the decision to use that product? I mean, it seems possible to me you could have product ready and a lack of clinical trial data to know how many micrograms to use or whether it needs to be adjuvanted or not.
Thank you. I appreciate the correction about FDA. What I'd like to clarify is that in the U.S., the influenza vaccines that we have licensed for use do not include adjuvants. In Europe, there are licensed adjuvanted vaccines that are used primarily in the elderly. So this is an issue of our licensure hasn't yet included any influenza vaccines with adjuvants. And we haven't seen an enormous safety database yet on those. The process here is that these recommendations will be reviewed quickly by CDC, and we're expecting them to rapidly be disseminated to the state and local health departments that are actively planning for vaccination efforts. So we think these recommendations will immediately be helpful to planners to start to reach out to the private providers and the private and public sector, as well as to communities. We also expect to be starting to get the word out to people about, are you in a group that ought to be thinking about the H1N1 vaccine when it becomes available, assuming we move forward with a large program? So we don't expect a delay of any major amount. Now, there are other steps, as you mentioned, in terms of other processes going forward. There are clinical trials going on, and there are a number of considerations. The FDA may license this H1N1 vaccine based on the applications from the companies, without waiting for any clinical trial data, just based on the way they license seasonal flu vaccine each year. The clinical trials will give us information that's helpful, but there are other decisions to be made going forward, really taking into account the circumstances. Is it more important to move forward before we have all the clinical information to really make sure we can take advantage of protection and based on the safety and immune response record of the seasonal flu vaccines? Or is it more important to go a little bit slower and wait for the results of these trials? This is something that the Health and Human Services agencies are looking into, and some of the advisory committees are also looking into that. The National Biodefense and Science, the National Biodefense Sciences Board, which advises HHS's preparedness group, has actually recommended, you know, going forward without waiting for those clinical trials, at least in some amounts of vaccine. This is a serious question that we're deliberating on right now. I also want to mention that we're doing a public engagement exercise to really understand values of the public in terms of how intense our vaccination efforts really ought to be. There's always this balance between prevention and information. Safety is a concern for people. You know, really what we want to understand where the public is on this matter, because it's a pretty big matter for consideration. Question in the room?
On that public message, is it dangerous, this counter-vaccination message that you heard in there today, that there are still people out there who believe that there is some risk involved in these vaccines? We interviewed someone today who told us that they thought that it was not clear that the benefits from these vaccines is actually greater than the risks. Could you talk to that, and do you really need to be a little bit more forceful on, you know, your thoughts on that message?
Vaccine safety is extremely important, and at CDC we value this highly. We really want to make sure that the interventions we recommend and promote are beneficial and that people have good information. It's critical to me that science is translated into accessible information and that the public, and particularly parents, can make good decisions for their children or their family's health. And so we know that there are some people who are reluctant to vaccinate and they have heard information that concerns them. I want to make sure they have good information to address those concerns so that they can make good choices. I think that's really critical. And going forward with an H1N1 vaccination program, very similar to our other vaccination efforts, safety information is important to people, and we need to share what we know when we know it, even if it's bad news going down the line. So I think we want to make that commitment to people. Oh, to the phone lines?
Our next question comes from Stephen Smith with the Boston Globe. Your line is open.
Good afternoon. I was hoping, first of all, to confirm that figure, that the target group recommendations would cover 160 million people. And then, secondly, I'm wondering what has been decided in terms of the dissemination of an H1N1 vaccine. In other words, will it piggyback on the existing system in place for seasonal flu vaccine, or given that there is likely to be a truncated timeline, is there going to be some system where it might be distributed through the Strategic National Stockpile Network? And also, in terms of payment, is it anticipated that there will be a mix similar to the seasonal vaccine, that some of it will be covered by private insurance, some of it will be covered by governmental agencies, both state and federal? Where is the thinking on those issues?
Thank you. The five target groups, the estimate is not clean. The estimate is 159 million, but there's a lot of overlap in some of the groups, so it's probably a lower number than that. What we try to stress is that we're not expecting, first of all, that there's overlap, and secondly, that with coverage expected to be 20 to 50% for seasonal flu, the size of that population may not be so relevant in terms of what the actual demand would be. You asked about the distribution and use of the vaccine. We are not expecting that this will work exactly the way the seasonal flu vaccine works. The federal government has procured the vaccine, and we're expecting the cost of the vaccine to be borne by the federal government. The administration for vaccination for vaccines, that we think would be more of a mix, that when vaccines delivered in public settings, at public health clinics or school immunization efforts or some of the community centers, that the vaccine administration costs would come out of the public resources that the health departments are receiving, but that when it's given in the private settings, in doctor's offices or retail settings, for instance, that insurance would be billed for that, whether it's public insurance like Medicaid or private insurance. And there's a set of activities going forward right now to make sure that we can make this smooth. As you say, this is different from seasonal influenza because we may be trying to vaccinate a lot of people relatively quickly, particularly if disease increases early this year, you know, when kids go back to school and so forth. And so we want to remove the barriers. We don't want people not to be able to access vaccine because they're not insured, and we don't want community clinics or school clinics to go very slowly or inefficiently because of needing to screen for insurance, for instance. So there's a lot of planning right now. It's intended that a formula or pro rata distribution of vaccine for the state and local program areas will go forward, and that they will be directing vaccine to both public and private settings. So we really want the private sector to help with this, but we know that that might not be enough, and we need the public sector to really be planning actively.
Do you have any other questions in the room?
Anything from the room?
All right, another one from the line, operator.
Our next question comes from Deborah Katz with U.S. News and World Report. Your line is open.
Great. Thanks for taking my question. I wanted to get back a little bit to the public education efforts. Wanted to ask, first of all, how the CDC plans to reassure the public who may be concerned because they've read reports about the last time swine flu vaccine was given and the association with GBS. And also wanted to ask if you are testing the vaccine in pregnant women, if they're part of the clinical trials.
Thanks. I'll do the questions in reverse. There are plans for testing of the vaccine in pregnancy, and the NIH is overseeing that effort. The information and communication is vital for any vaccination program, and particularly for something like this, when we have a new H1N1 strain, a lot of concern in the spring, disease in children, really, really charged issues, you know, these deaths in pregnant women, really some tragic events that concern all of us, and also a population that has questions about vaccines. So we are intensively planning a communication and education program, and we're also intensively planning a safety monitoring program. There's only so much information we can learn about safety before vaccines go into people because they're not tested in millions of people. Even if the tests go all the way till the conclusion, it will be hundreds or thousands, not really hundreds of thousands and millions of people. And to find those rare severe events, like a Guillain-Barré syndrome scenario that happened in 1976, it's really only when vaccine goes out in large numbers that that becomes evident. So it's vital to us to have a good monitoring system that if there are problems, we want to be able to interpret them quickly, figure out whether they are coincidences or are real, and really take action. So I think that it's very important for people to have good information about what's the disease likely to be, what do we know about the vaccine, and to make good choices. But we are planning both an education information program and also a safety monitoring program. Another question from the phone next.
Okay. Our next question is from Shelley Adler with the Associated Press.
Hi, thanks for taking my question. I'd like to know how dangerous the H1N1 virus is for pregnant women and why.
Thank you. We have seen pregnant women disproportionately affected from this virus. They have apparently about a fourfold increased risk of being hospitalized compared to the general population that gets this virus. So we do think that when influenza, including this H1N1 virus, strikes pregnant women, worse things happen. We've had a number of deaths among pregnant women, and it really saddens us to know about those. It's vital for pregnant women who have respiratory illness and fever to get early treatment. We think that antiviral medicines for them can be life-saving and that that's a very important message. We also think it's important for them to get seasonal influenza vaccine, and today the committee recommended that when vaccine's available and we have a decision to go forward, that pregnant women really ought to consider getting the H1N1 vaccine. So they are at higher risk of bad complications of influenza. We should go in the room here.
Denise Grady.
Okay.
Okay. Denise Grady from the New York Times. I just wondered if you could clarify something that Dr. Fiore said during his briefing, and that was, is obesity all by itself a risk factor, or was it not? I'm sorry, I missed what he said.
The information is incomplete right now to the best of our, basically, as we look at patterns of disease among people who are obese and people who aren't obese, we don't see as big a difference as you might expect. But when we look at people who are morbidly obese, extremely obese, with, I think, BMIs over 40, they did appear to have worse complications from the H1N1 virus than do others. It's important to say that a majority of people who were either obese or who were morbidly obese had other medical risk factors for influenza and its complications, so they were often likely to have diabetes or chronic diseases of various types that put them at higher risk of complications. When we look at the group that only had morbid obesity or only had obesity, it's not so clear. Okay, let me clarify. So
what I was trying to get at was they would not be
a target group, right?
Right.
So
okay.
what I think it's important to say is that most people, the committee reviewed the data on the underlying risk factors that were occurring in people with this H1N1 virus and really found similar patterns to the seasonal influenza risk factors. And most of the people that are getting these hospitalizations or deaths really do have an existing ACIP indication. A lot of those who were showing up as people with morbid obesity have chronic respiratory disease or have other conditions, diabetes and so forth, that would put them already on the list. So we don't think we're missing a lot of people.
Do we have any more from the room? Let's go to the line, operator.
Our next question comes from Molly McRae with KPIX-TV. Your line is open.
Yes, hi. I didn't hear the information that I guess Denise Grady was referring to with at the press conference regarding obesity. So an underlying medical condition does not include obesity in and of itself. So the otherwise healthy obese patients would not be a target population, even though that case study done by the CDC seemed to indicate that some of the morbidly obese had no diagnosed underlying condition.
The recommendations of the committee today stress to use the available list of risk factors that ACIP has traditionally used for seasonal influenza. I do think issues like morbid obesity remain under discussion, and new information may be forthcoming that would amend this. So I think it's reasonable for people to have an open mind about that. At this point, we think most people that are at high risk would be covered with the indications that are already listed, but you know, I would say the book's not closed on that one.
Those indications would be on the ACIP website?
Oh, what are they? I'm sorry. The indications for seasonal influenza are, first I'm going to say they're on our website because I might miss a couple, but they include chronic respiratory disease, chronic heart disease, chronic lung disease is already included, chronic liver disease and chronic kidney disease, diabetes, immunosuppressive conditions or immunosuppressive medicines, pregnancy. These are the underlying conditions. There are, of course, another set of conditions that are age-related or household contact-related. Those are the majority, I believe, that I've just listed. Okay, so I think we had a question in the room.
Thanks, Mike from the AP again. The potential for confusion this fall is just through the roof. And you're a clinician. I was wondering, as elderly people come in, what do doctors tell them? Because they're coming in for the seasonal flu, but they're not supposed to get this.
Yeah.
And then, of course, pregnant women, that's been a challenge. Only 15% get immunized. And we heard somebody from NIH say the evidence is scanty, I think is the word he used, in terms of safety data on that. Just as a clinician, how are you going to talk to patients, or what do you advise other doctors to say to keep all this straight and get the right people in?
You know, I think that's a great question. As a clinician and as a public health expert, I talk to people about vaccines all the time. And one of the tragedies is most people who have one of these risk factors don't even recognize that they're at risk. So it's really important that healthcare workers have a heightened awareness about this issue. And the first thing that's important is that they get vaccinated, both with seasonal flu vaccine and with the H1N1 vaccine when it becomes available. They're our frontline. What they do influences their patients. As a provider with a person, an elderly person coming in to see me, I would strongly recommend the seasonal influenza vaccine right now and tell them that, you know, from most of what we've seen so far, it looks like you're probably going to be spared. You're probably very low risk for this new virus compared to younger people. That's the best data we have today. I do think it's important for us to be offering the seasonal flu vaccine as soon as it's available. And, of course, as information changes, we'll be addressing, we'll be adjusting our advice.
Operator, we can take one more question from the phone.
Our next question comes from Stacey Singer with the Palm Beach Post. Your line is open.
Hi. Could you please explain why, what the 6 months, what is it about 6 months
sure.
that makes the household contact?
Yes, thank you. Children under 6 months are not able to be vaccinated directly, yet they have a high risk of hospitalization, both for seasonal influenza and we fear for this new virus. And because they can't be directly protected, the public health strategy is to protect those around them to keep them from spreading the virus to them. So for our seasonal influenza vaccination recommendations and for other vaccines such as the Tdap vaccine, the whooping cough vaccine for adults, we really want people who are around young children, young babies, to be protected so that the baby, the under 6 months old, can be protected. So the recommendation for the H1N1 vaccine, like the seasonal vaccine, for household contacts of those under 6 months, is in order to protect that baby who can't themselves be vaccinated, but who is at risk for hospitalization.
So thanks very much. This concludes our briefing. Thanks for joining us online and for those of you who came in.
And this concludes today's conference. I want to thank you for your participation. You may disconnect at this time.